What's it sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning?
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Growing Up with Chapel Hill, The Village, from 1901 to 1925. By Jane Toy Coolidge. Continuing with Chapter 8, Main Street. At the east end of the business section, opposite the campus, was Mr. H. H. Hoot Patterson's store, an old and respected institution. Its prestige was well deserved, not only because of seniority, but because it was a high-class establishment. Housed in a large, airy building, it was a pleasant place, its floor well swept, its shelves orderly, its service dignified and courteous. Groceries filled one side of the store, shoes, yard goods, and notions the other. Such an arrangement was the rule among most of the village merchants. They kept general stores, and if you couldn't find what you wanted at one, you could try another, and another, always with a chance of success. Stroud's store, in the middle of the block, was one of these, and Eubank's, farther up on the other side of the street, was another. This belonged to Mr. Bob Eubank's, who dealt mostly in groceries, and must not be confused with Mr. Clyde Eubank's drugstore. Mr. Patterson's store had a long and honorable life, stocking goods of the highest quality and dispensing them fittingly. When telephones were introduced, ladies could call up and give their orders, sure that just what they wanted would be delivered by Mr. Patterson's Jim in his horse-drawn wagon. And a little girl who had saved 4 pennies could go in with her mother and buy lemon and peppermint drops in a small red and white striped paper bag. Next to Mr. Patterson's store was Tom Dunstan's barber shop, also a high-class establishment. Tom was a dignified colored man, a friend of the great and near great, whose mugs with names in gilt letters he kept on his shelves. Framed photographs of some of these gentlemen hung on the shop's walls, and once a new professor, impressed by the distinguished company, offered to give Tom his picture to add to his collection. With the greatest courtesy, Tom told him he could not accept the offer. These were the pictures of his close friends, and were given only on special request. Collier Cobb, Jr. tells of this incident, and also quotes Tom Dunstan's comment when Dr. Venable succeeded Dr. Edwin Alderman as president of the university. "Yes, sir," Tom said. "But he can't dilate, expatiate, paraphrase, and prevaricate like Marse Ed." Later, the site of the barber shop was occupied with a pressing club, a business establishment that collected, cleaned, and pressed men's suits. Such clubs were a popular and profitable source of income for the students who ran them. After that, the building housed Cy Thompson's insurance office, and still later, a record shop. At the west end of the business block on Franklin Street were Herndon's Hardware Store and Lee's Meat Market, and in between was Eubank's Drug Store. This last was near the Tankersley residence, and was a pleasant haven on summer afternoons, when you could sit on a wire-backed chair at a little round table and sip a cherry phosphate. After years at this location, Mr. Eubank's moved up the street to a fine new building across from the post office. These bright and airy quarters became a popular mid-morning gathering place that was like a social club. Dr. Brack Lloyd would sit by the sunny front window where friends would join him to drink Cokes, we called them dopes, and swap gossip. Ladies sat at nearby tables and joined in the fun. Mr. Clyde Eubanks was a dignified but genial host, and Carl Durham, later to be our congressman, his able assistant. The store was immaculately neat, orderly and businesslike. Its pharmacy maintained the highest professional standards. The social atmosphere was a natural development, a serendipitous bonus. Close at hand was Mr. Sorrell's jewelry store, where you could have your watch fixed, your picture taken, and your glasses mended. Mr. Sorrell was a man of many talents. He kept bees at home. Neighbors here in the middle of the block were our financial institutions, the People's Bank and the Bank of Chapel Hill, where Mr. Jim Taylor was the cashier. On the other, south side of the street, next to the post office, were two stores, Webb's Men's Furnishings and Neville's Sporting Goods and Ice Cream Parlor, both patronized largely by students. Up a short alley was Tank Hunter's Livery Stable, in quarters later occupied by Bruce Stroud's garage. Beyond the alley was a big old residence which had become a boarding house, and was run as such by Mrs. Daniels before she moved to the corner of Columbia Street and Cameron Avenue. Mrs. Daniels' daughter, Josephine, a beautiful blonde, was a high school belle who wore elegant Hofflin suits, meticulously tailored midi blouses and pleated skirts that were the height of fashion for the younger set. The express office and Mr. Bob Eubank's grocery were farther up the street, next to Durham's store on the corner. Across from here, facing Columbia Street, where the Baptist Church now stands, was Emerson's store, where men lounged in tilted chairs in the sunshine. My mental picture of this scene focuses on the occasion when one of these men was pointed out to me as Bun Hearn, the big league baseball player, returned to his native heath to bask in glory. I didn't know what all this meant, but I was much impressed. Behind this store, facing Franklin Street, was a small one-story house belonging to an elderly couple, Mr. and Mrs. McDade. Their nephew, Isaac Emerson, had once lived with them and started his career as a druggist here, experimenting with a soothing concoction later developed into Bromo Seltzer, the source of millions of dollars, some of which he gave to the university for the Emerson Stadium. On the north side of Franklin Street, across from the McDade home, was a small, low building which housed our first bakery. Until it opened, somewhere around 1914, homemade bread had been the rule in Chapel Hill, with, of course, plenty of hot biscuits, rolls, spoon bread, and corn dodgers to lend variety. My father, always in favor of progress, hailed the bakery as a big step forward, and so it was, though I'm afraid its products weren't exactly gourmet items. The baker was a sad, pasty-faced man, whose wife was not well. At the other end of the long business block was Henderson Street, and here the telephone company occupied a strategic spot a few doors from the corner. Telephones, of course, were in tall wooden boxes that hung on the wall, and the service was pleasantly personal. We had numbers. Our family's was 33, but if you couldn't remember the one you wanted, you said, "Give me Mr. Cobb's residence, please," and the operator obliged. She was just around the corner from Patterson's store, and when my mother couldn't get an answer there, the operator, we called her Central, would say, "Just a minute, Mrs. Toy, I'll run over and see what's the matter with them." She was also helpful in time of need. "Too bad you haven't been able to find any eggs," she would volunteer. "Why don't you let me call Neville's store out at Carborough? They got some in this morning." A later operator occupied the time between calls by doing fine embroidery. Beautiful initials on the big linen dinner napkins my mother gave me when I was married were her work. I think it was Miss Mamie Gooch whose needle was so skillful. The Gooch family was active in town affairs, their best-known venture being Gooch's Cafe. Here you could get a cup of coffee or a whole meal at any hour of the day or night. This was a great convenience, and a real public service in time of need. Few people had occasion to eat out, for there was a cook in every kitchen. Students and bachelor professors patronized boarding houses on a regular monthly basis, so the cafe wasn't apt to be crowded. But it was a valued institution, and we were glad it was there. Our first theater, the Pickwick, was several doors down from Andrew's store. When it opened its doors, I don't know. but it flourished during the Perils of Pauline era and was packed with students every night. They called it the Rat House and said rats sat on beams overhead, dodging peanuts and other missiles. Such extra entertainment made attendance at the first show a hazardous adventure. If you wanted to watch the picture, you went to the second show. At the piano below the screen, an accomplished performer kept the music going in spite of constant yells, flying peanuts, and ribald comments on the picture. She was Mabel Thompson, a young woman of talent and character, who put up with all the horseplay, kept her temper, and stuck to her job with unflappable equanimity. She was a good sport, but drew a firm line between decency and dirt. The student audience soon found this out and respected her unspoken rule. She played steadily through two shows every night, suiting the music to the action on the screen with adept discrimination. Affectionately known as Pickwick Mabel, she continued to be a popular member of the village community long after the old theater was closed. And now, as Mrs. V.A. Hill, she is an active and respected figure in the new Chapel Hill. Though the Pickwick was our first theater, before its day, the university had recognized the new art of the cinema by showing an occasional film in Girard Hall. Such productions were more in the character of scientific experiments than popular entertainment. As Dr. Johnson said of women preachers and walking dogs, the point was not how well they did it, but that they did it at all. My first recollection of a movie is of Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, shown here in the early years of the century. The old Pickwick flourished unchallenged until around 1915, when a new Pickwick was built and a rival theater opened just across the street. Gone were the rats, if they had ever existed. Gone the peanut battles. Gone the pianist. Time had marched on. Main Street, really Franklin, but we usually said Main, was truly the heart of the town. The post office in those early years was on the south side of the street, two or three doors up from the Methodist Church, and here, twice a day, we went to get the mail. Of course, there was no delivery. Everybody had a box opened by a combination known only to members of the family. Mail time was a social hour and an exciting part of the day. In later years, the present post office was built down on the other side of the street, where Mrs. McNider's house used to stand. The long business block extended from the corner of Columbia Street down to Patterson's store and Tom Dunstan's barber shop, just across from the campus. There was no pavement on Center Road or sidewalk. Mud was a fact of life half of the time, and, during the other half, dust rose in clouds when buggies and wagons came along. These conditions didn't worry anybody. We accepted them as inevitable and resented comments from outsiders, especially from Durham people who were inclined to remark on our countrified state. Besides being the business district, the long block in the center of the village was the scene of community activities. One of these was fire practice, held on summer evenings when members of the volunteer company raced down the middle of the street pulling the reel, connected the rows, and squirted a stream of water up in a high, triumphal arc. All this was timed to the last second, and after weeks of diligent practice, the team would go to compete in the state tournament at Asheville, or some other distant metropolis. On practice nights, everybody who could get through supper early congregated downtown to wait impatiently through the seemingly endless preliminaries. At last, the cry went up, "Here they come!" And you pushed through the crowd to watch spellbound while the team dashed past and finished the run in a cascade of glory. Our hearts were filled with loving loyalty for these brave friends who strove so hard to protect us from flaming peril and carried Chapel Hill's banner proudly throughout the state. And down Franklin Street marched our one parade, held on Memorial Day, the 10th of May. We called it Old Soldiers' Day, and that is what it was. Gray-bearded Confederate veterans plodded or shuffled or were driven in wagons down past Dr. Klutz's store, the post office, the Methodist Church, and the Tankersley's house, to stop at the campus. Here, in front of the monument to the heroes of the lost cause, they sat at long tables and partook of the bountiful meal prepared by devoted women, most of them daughters of the Confederacy. My mother always sent a big tray loaded with apple turnovers, half-moon finger pies, the pastry cut out around a saucer, one half filled with luscious fruit, the other half folded over and pricked around the edges. There were speeches, mercifully brief because the old soldier's strength was limited. The college band played the Bonnie Blue Flag, and a male quartet stood in front of the Confederate monument and sang Tenting Tonight on the Old Campground. Dr. Charlie Mangum's tenor soared above the rest, and some of the ladies wiped away tears. Then everybody who could walk proceeded to the cemetery, where small Confederate flags were placed on a great many graves. The Stars and Bars was a cherished emblem still, not to be treated lightly or displayed at such frivolous celebrations as ball games. It stood for Southern ideals still living in a changed world. When we looked at it, we thought of the men who had followed it into battle gaily and willingly, and without regret, giving their all for what they believed was right. Chapter 9, The Wide Blue Yonder. The year 1910 stands out as a most important one in our family history, for it was then that we went to Europe. After 25 years of teaching, Walter Toy was granted sabbatical leave to study at the universities of Berlin and Heidelberg, a project long dreamed of and carefully prepared for. During these years, money had been put aside from each modest salary check, and now there was enough to take us to Germany for a 14-month stay. I was 8 years old, and such financial details meant nothing to me, if indeed I ever heard them mentioned, which I doubt, for my parents never talked about money before the children. I only knew that we were going away on a long trip. My brothers and I complicated matters by breaking out with chicken pox a few weeks before the scheduled departure date in May. If this caused our mother some anxious moments, she didn't let us see it while she nursed us. When not in the sick room, she kept on packing trunks and suitcases with everything we would need during the coming year. And she also had to get the house ready for the friends who were to occupy it while we were away. Being normally healthy children, we recovered from our ailments in due time and shed our spots. We were all ready and waiting when finally the carriage from the livery stable came to take us to the station. There were five of us, my brothers Calvert, 2 years older than I, and Walter, 5 years younger, our parents, and myself. To put us all on the sleeper for New York after the change of trains at University Station must have been quite a job, but my father was an experienced traveler, and the trip was accomplished safely. As for the overnight stop in the city, the thing that stands out in my memory is an elegant planked steak dinner at our hotel. Next day, we boarded the Rotterdam and started across the Atlantic. This ship, then the third largest passenger liner in the world, was to us children quite literally a floating palace. We were in second class, but our stateroom, with its ingenious space-saving devices, was very comfortable. There was no private bath, but in a large room down the hall, a buxom stewardess filled a tub with steaming salt water and plumped me into it. I was surprised and shocked, for I wasn't used to such unceremonious handling, but she was so big and calm and utterly unconcerned that I found myself accepting the procedure without question. Every morning, the room steward brought us a big plate of oranges, apples, and bananas, a treat that we enjoyed tremendously. The dining salon, lounges, and decks were spacious and, to our eyes, most luxurious. We never tired of roaming through them in search of new discoveries. On board with us was another Chapel Hill family, Dr. and Mrs. Wheeler, their two sons, and Mrs. Wheeler's mother and sister. A snapshot taken on the upper deck shows us all together, a happy-looking group, the women wearing hats held on by scarves tied under the chin, the men in jaunty visored caps. When we landed in Rotterdam, the two families went their separate ways, the Toys staying in Holland for a few days sightseeing in The Hague, the island of Marken, and other interesting places. Then we took the train for Berlin, where my father had arranged for us to stay at a pension recommended by friends. The pension was run by Frau von Rada, the widow of an army officer, and was located in a modern apartment house where three flats had been thrown together. Built around a grassy courtyard, the white stucco building had many balconies whose window boxes were filled with bright blossoms. Inside our apartments, heavy furniture and dark red curtains were less attractive, but gave promise of solid comfort. Frau von Rada made it her business to supply this comfort, and ran the place like a major general. A tall, slender, dignified woman of uncertain age, she presided over a household made up of several young American students, our family, two maids, and an elderly female pensioner. This decayed gentlewoman was referred to by Frau von Rada as die Degenhart, and bullied unmercifully. I think our hostess's husband must have been a typical Prussian martinet, and she too belonged in this category. Her son, also an army officer, lived in a large apartment on the first floor of the building across the court from us. We were told that army regulations prevented his marrying until he could show evidence that his bride had sufficient means to maintain a standard of living suitable to his rank. He had found such a wife in the person of a Hawaiian heiress who, my mother said, looked like a former queen of the islands. The couple had a son, Dita, about the age of my brother Walter, then five, and the little boys played happily together, unhampered by differing backgrounds. We were soon settled in our new home, and a governess engaged to teach my brothers and me German. She accomplished this painlessly by taking us on daily excursions to a nearby park where we met other children, bounced balls with them, and were introduced to Diabolo, a game played with a wooden spool whirled and tossed on a string tied to two sticks held one in each hand. This was the current fad, a predecessor of hula hoops and skateboards. It required considerable skill and practice, and kept us busy for hours while we made friends with other children and picked up enough German to communicate with them. It was summer, and the bright days were ideal for such hours in the park and for excursions farther afield to the zoo, a special delight for us because in remote Chapel Hill there had never been even a passing circus. With these daily diversions, the weeks passed quickly, and soon it was time for us to go to school. Calvert was enrolled in the gymnasium, Walter in kindergarten, and I in a private school for girls. I remember my first day there, when I was deposited in a room full of girls about my own age, but quite different in appearance, because they all had long braids or lots of curly hair. My straight hair was cut in a square Dutch bob, and the sight of it must have given them a dreadful shock, for they stared at me in amazement, tinged with horror. When recess time came, and we were taken down to the courtyard, they continued to stare, and my parents, standing with the headmistress on a balcony, heard one of them exclaim, "Mein Gott, ein Mädchen ohne Haare!" A girl without hair. In spite of this inauspicious beginning, my days at the school were happy. My classmates, once they got over their shock, accepted the stranger in their midst and became warm friends. They invited me to parties, stilted little functions arranged according to a strictly conventional code of etiquette. Their homes were scattered throughout the city, and my father must have had some problems locating these unfamiliar places and escorting me to them. I have a picture of the class sitting at desks in the schoolroom, 20 little girls, immaculately neat, with smiling faces, their bright eyes looking eagerly towards the future. This was 1910. In 4 more years, the foundations of their world collapsed. What happened to my friends Blum Gutzeit, she was Jewish, I think, and Hilda Lernert, and the rest, I do not know, and to Fraulein Trost, who taught us. In the picture, she stands beside the window, looking down at her pupils, a tall, serene young woman who was one of the best teachers I ever had. Kind, gentle, authoritative, and unperturbed, she was always ready to help a shy little stranger in a strange land. Calvert, 2 years my senior, attended the gymnasium, an institution comparable to an American high school for boys. He, too, made friends, some of whom he brought home to meet the family. One of these was Kurt Schippe, a handsome youth so proud of his English vocabulary that, in the midst of a serious conversation, he blurted out two words, "Plum pudding." I wonder what lay ahead for him. Militarism was in the air. Soldiers marched through the streets, goose-stepping like marionettes. Museums were full of enormous paintings depicting battle scenes, always German victories, and other museums displayed gorgeous uniforms, weapons, ancient and modern, and all kinds of military equipment. Shops offered paper cutouts, faithfully representing German regiments, authentically portrayed down to the last button. And there were thousands of lead soldiers, figures of warriors through the ages, from knights of old to modern infantrymen, miniatures so beautifully designed and decorated that they were real works of art. All these fascinated my brother Calvert, an impressionable adolescent. Arms and armor, military strategy, the power and pageantry of war, became his consuming interest. Sunday after Sunday, he made his way to museums featuring these things, and when parades and reviews were staged, he sought them out and became an eager spectator. I wonder if this youthful experience had anything to do with the fact that 6 years later, when the United States declared war on Germany, Calvert became one of the youngest officers in the American Army, detained for 2 days at Plattsburgh after summer training there, while Congress lowered the age limit and enabled him to be commissioned. And again, after Pearl Harbor, he said goodbye to an extensive practice as a successful physician and went back into the service. But these things were undreamed of when he, and sometimes our whole family, attended military spectacles in Berlin. These popular events were highly publicized and sponsored by the Kaiser himself, whose picture was prominently displayed in all public places, and many private ones, throughout the city. The stern, mustachioed countenance beneath the eagle-crowned helmet became as familiar as the face of the policeman on the corner. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I think I wish and hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.